teacher. It's my understanding that Ms. Larson is senior certified and will argue on behalf of the appellee. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
You're probably glad all those students left.
Told me to wait. I just ignored you. Apologize. Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Abby Osborne of Schiffer Miller Law Office on behalf of the appellant Amanda Stevens. Your Honor, I think the very first and foremost most important thing in this case is that the trial court committed reversible error not once but twice for issuing the wrong standard as to whether or not summary judgment was appropriate, and I think that is something that can't be fixed absent a remand. It taints the entirety of the opinion and of the analysis and the factual analysis in this matter. Twice, the trial court referred to a heightened burden of proof required, indicating that the plaintiff failed to satisfy the heightened burden of proof required to demonstrate pretext and regarding the removal and termination from her one position, as well as a separate incident. Later in the opinion, again, the trial court stated that the plaintiff failed to satisfy the heightened burden of proof required with regard to removal from the weed control authority position. And this is highly problematic because nowhere in the case law or in the statutes does it require a heightened burden of proof for pretext or a prima facie case. This has been addressed by this court in Helvering, setting forth the standard, adopting the United States Supreme Court case in Burdine, that the fact finder need only find by a preponderance of the evidence for the prima facie case of discrimination or pretext. And as this court is familiar, preponderance of the evidence is the lowest of the typical burdens of proof, lower than clear and convincing evidence, and certainly lower than beyond a reasonable doubt. And preponderance of the evidence is the standard civil burden of proof. And there's no indication that there is any higher burden of proof for a plaintiff in order for them to succeed. Quite the opposite. I think that if the summary judgment standard is applied appropriately, a non-moving party is actually held to a lesser standard because all inferences from any factual dispute are to be found in their favor. So a non-moving party, the plaintiff, appellant in this case, need only present facts to put the material facts in question, and their facts are to be believed, even if a jury could eventually find the moving party's version of the facts more credible. That is not what the trial court is to be doing in a motion for summary judgment. The trial court is to be weighing it in the favor of the non-moving plaintiff. This is described in the Valmont Industries case, which was cited in our brief. That's an Eighth Circuit case, which has been cited by this court and the Nebraska Supreme Court several times as well. In that summary judgment case, the court noted that it was surely the kind of fact which could cause a reasonable trier of fact to raise an eyebrow. That is the standard that a non-moving party is appropriately held to, is present facts sufficient that a juror could raise an eyebrow, not that you have a slam dunk case that you can win this. And because the trial court has twice indicated that the plaintiff needed to meet a higher burden of proof.
Is that the language the court used?
Heightened burden of proof required. And that's on page 42 and again on page 46 of the transcript in somewhat the conclusory paragraphs of those sections of the court's order. But in both instances, it says heightened burden of proof twice. The plaintiff failed to satisfy the heightened burden of proof, which is just not anywhere within the case law on fair employment cases, federal or state law, and is contrary essentially to the summary judgment standard.
But Ms. Osborne, even setting aside the use of the word heightened, the district court essentially found that the plaintiff failed to meet her burden of proof with regard to being qualified to perform her job, right?
Yes.
And what evidence was there that she was qualified to perform her job?
Your Honor, I think that the question and the lens for which that was viewed in, and let me get to my...
You know, to make a prima facie case of gender discrimination, she had to prove that, and the county didn't dispute, she was a member of a protected class, and she had an adverse employment action. She was terminated. But one of the factors is also that she was qualified to perform her job, and
yes,
all the evidence that was presented indicated she was not.
Judge, and I think that that views that question through the wrong lens, and is the subject of the question here. The material fact wasn't whether the county felt that she was not qualified to perform her job. I would position that anybody could be found not to be qualified to perform their job. If we're going to laser focus in on someone and point out their every mistake and hold them accountable for every mistake while letting their comparators, and the term comparator is broader than what the appellee suggests in their brief. But by looking, if we're only going to look at Ms. Stevens' performance and we're going to go, well, gosh darn it, we found 3 mistakes this week and 5 mistakes this week and 4 mistakes here. But if we are not looking at the other people who hold same or similar jobs, then we need to be comparing whether or not she's qualified to perform her position compared to the other people who are similarly performing their job.
What evidence was there that other people in her position, you know, made continuous errors in their data entry? You know, pretty much every month there was some kind of disciplinary action underway.
I think that the best evidence of that is the evidence related to Mr. Stidham, who was the predecessor, who was doing the same job.
Does it matter? Didn't he have a different supervisor?
You know, I think technically he did have a different supervisor, but then we get into a whole cat's paw type of deal, and we've got Mr. Aganaw supervising and highly involved in both of these situations, coming at these individuals, and we've got Mr. Stidham, the man here, who ultimately gets terminated from his job for legitimate reasons, but they are monitoring his performance. They're noting that other individuals are also making mistakes, and we are not laser focusing on these other individuals. The material fact here is when you view Ms. Stevens compared to or similarly and with the same lens to her contemporaries, she is qualified, and the things that we're calling her unqualified for, we are letting other individuals do. So I think
what evidence was presented to establish that she was qualified?
That she was qualified?
Yes.
I think there isn't any affirmative evidence. There's no dispute that she was, in fact, creating mistakes. Whether you make mistakes or not, the standard is not perfection. Mistakes are allowed for other people, but mistakes were not allowed to her, the woman. Mistakes were allowed to the men, but mistakes were not allowed to her, the individual
Would you agree that to be qualified for a job, you need to be competent in your performance of that job?
Yes, but I think that what the county is arguing, that she was not competent, is only a supportable argument if you ignore the fact that the other people who are performing their job similarly, that are being found to be competent in their job, are not getting challenged and disciplined for the same and similar errors. That's the distinction.
What evidence was there of similarly situated employees not being treated the same way without the same expectations?
The affidavit of Mr. Stidham, which is an affidavit, that was something that was raised in the brief of the appellee as well. The affidavit of Mr. Stidham is a sworn statement that the appellee didn't understand, that an NEOC charge is actually an affidavit, a sworn statement made on personal knowledge, as well as the statements of the declarant, of the appellee, that other people were making mistakes and it was okay, and the evaluation from the 6-month probationary period where it does indicate that there are mistakes, try not to make the mistakes, and then the mistakes that are being noted in these daily things that are coming up and highlighting these suspensions are things that just by chance are being noted. So she did work during that first 6 months on a deed made an error, and then later somebody comes back, looks at that deed, and sees that there's an error, and she's getting punished for it in real time, which is part of what prompted the challenge to those things under the county collective bargaining agreement. And so there is considerable evidence, especially when viewed through the non-heightened standard, and when you view these people similarly, as opposed to taking them for their word that she was poorly performing compared to other people without the comparison of other people, when there are statements and documentary evidence indicating that there were other people. That is something that should have been left to the jury, and the matter should be remanded for evaluation under the appropriate standard and trial before the jury.
Thank you.
Ms.
Osborne, I don't see you having had made an appearance in this
case. Your Honor, I did file an appearance just yesterday.
Okay, all right. I don't have it yet. Okay,
certainly
thank
I
you.
Have the filing, but I can
okay.
provide
thank
another.
You. Thank you.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Maureen Larson. I am here on behalf of the County of Lancaster. I'm a senior certified law student being supervised by Christy Bauer. The appellant failed to show that her disciplinary actions were motivated or caused by gender discrimination or retaliation. I'd first like to discuss the appellant's argument that the court applied the wrong standard in making its determination. In the appellant's brief, she makes two arguments. The first is that the court did not make a finding that there was no genuine issue of material fact. The court did make this express finding on page 10 of the court's order. Second, the appellant argues that this court's language in its order that the appellant had failed to satisfy the heightened burden of proof required was the wrong standard being applied to this case. However, this was a correct application of the McDonnell-Douglas framework, which this court has adopted. This statement was taken out of context, and it was being applied to the appellant's burden to show that the county's articulated reason for her disciplinary actions was pretext for discrimination or retaliation. In Helvering, this court said, although strong evidence of a prima facie case can also be considered to establish pretext, proof of pretext or actual discrimination requires more substantial evidence. That is the heightened burden that the court was speaking about in its order. In Reason, this court said temporal proximity may arguably be enough to establish a prima facie case of retaliation, but temporal proximity alone is not enough to overcome specific, direct, and considerable evidence regarding an employee's poor job performance. And that is what the county presented. County presented evidence that this employee had had two verbal warnings, a written reprimand, three separate suspensions, a letter proposing her termination, and she was counseled in both her six-month review and her one-year performance evaluation about the amount of errors that she was making.
What about the comparison with Mr. Stidham?
Mr. Stidham is not a valid comparator in this case, Your Honor. He is a former employee at the Register of Deeds. He was not the predecessor of this employee. He was in a different department, he had a different job classification, and he had different supervisors. He was not held the same standards as Ms. Stevens was. In addition, Mr. Stidham was not raised in the appellant's complaint or her brief in opposition to summary judgment.
But was there evidence from him offered at the summary judgment hearing?
The only references to Mr. Stidham were when, during Mr. Colgrove's deposition, when the appellant's counsel introduced the charge of discrimination that was purportedly filed by Mr. Stidham against the county. And then again, at the motion for summary judgment hearing, when the appellant's counsel attempted to introduce that deposition, the county properly objected. This is a self-serving statement, and at the deposition at which the appellant's counsel attempted to introduce this piece of evidence, or purported evidence, Mr. Colgrove, whose deposition was being taken, was not competent to testify about this. Mr. Colgrove denied having any knowledge of the reason for Mr. Colgrove's termination or about the purported charge of discrimination. This was not admissible evidence, yet the appellant is using him to try to establish him as a valid comparator. Even though there's no evidence that he made similar errors, both in frequency and in seriousness to Stevens, and there's no evidence that he was or was not disciplined for these errors.
I think the appellant made reference to an affidavit, the NEOC.
There was a charge of discrimination that included that was filed against the county in a separate case, and the appellant's counsel represented Mr. Stidham in that case.
So was any of that offered as evidence at the summary judgment hearing?
That was offered as part of the deposition of Mr. Robert Colgrove. However, the county objected to that, and the court admitted it for purposes of summary judgment, subject to the county's objection. And our argument is that that piece of evidence is not admissible because, one, it is a self-serving statement, and because it was introduced at a deposition where the deponent did not have any knowledge of the facts that were in that piece of evidence. The wrong standard is not what was applied here. The heightened burden of proof is not more than a preponderance of evidence. It was a preponderance of evidence that was applied. The wrong standard that the appellant is arguing is the appellant's or the plaintiff's burden to establish that pretext. The pretext in this case was the appellant was trying to establish pretext by the temporal proximity between the appellant's termination or removal from her position at the Weed Control Authority and her attending an NEOC rebuttal conference. The county does not deny that this was a protected activity, her attending this conference, or that her removal from this position was an adverse employment action, but there was no causation established. And the county conceded for purpose of the prima facie case that she had made a prima facie case of retaliation because of that temporal proximity, because it can arguably establish in a prima facie case, an evidence of pretext or an inference. However, there is a heightened burden when the ultimate burden is on the plaintiff to establish that Lancaster County's articulated reason for poor job performance was the reason for her disciplinary actions.
And the initial termination letter, proposed termination letter, occurred 5 days before she actually filed the NEOC complaint.
Yes, Your Honor. The proposed termination was prior to her filing the complaint. The county did not get notice of that complaint until July 31st. She actually left that position and transferred to a different position within Lancaster County prior to that complaint being filed.
So a decision had already been made to terminate her employment before she ever filed the complaint.
It was subject to a pre-disciplinary meeting, Your Honor. She did have the offer proposing her termination. However,
changed her job at that point.
Correct. She had already accepted a job at a different department within the county, and she asked to waive her 2 weeks' notice and basically be allowed to do a transfer. However, because that transfer was, in a sense, a promotion, she was being paid more. According to Lancaster County personnel rules, if you do not complete successfully your probationary period in a promoted job, then you're allowed to retreat back to your prior job. And that's what happened in this case. So it is a little bit confusing with the record why she had two different jobs. She went from one, she got promoted, and then she's removed from that job. However, she was permitted back under the Lancaster County personnel rules to retreat to her prior
job. So those rules allow an employee to retreat even though they were under a pending termination when they left?
It does. And she had not been terminated. She had been proposed termination, and we, under the union contract, she was subject to, she had the right to have a pre-disciplinary meeting, which did not occur because she had applied for a different job within the county, and she asked to be able to complete that.
So did the weed control supervisor identify problems with her before or after he learned about the NEOC claim?
There's no evidence that he knew about the claim.
Well, she testified in her deposition he did.
She did, and that statement is taken out of context. She testified that during her meeting after she was being removed from her position at the Weed Control Authority, that her supervisor said that it was because he couldn't trust her because of her complaints. That is not a correct statement of what happened. There's a transcript.
But didn't she say that on September 2nd, she told Meyer, her supervisor at the Weed Control, that she had a hearing regarding the appeal of her disciplinary action?
That is alleged in her brief on appeal, Your Honor. However, there is no evidence in the record that that had occurred. The poor performance had begun, and her supervisor at the Weed Control Authority had begun to notice her poor performance as early as September 16th. September 18th, he spoke with the director of HR, Human Resources, and he was told to document issues that he had noticed. Specifically, he had noticed that she was having an inordinate amount of personal internet use during her work hours. He testified, and she admitted to her internet use during work hours after she was removed from the position. That's in the transcript of that meeting, which was typed up and part of the record. She admitted to that. This was the main concern that she was removed from that position for, and because this was known prior to any evidence that Mr. Brent Meyer knew about any of her complaints, this would destroy any pretext that would be raised by just the temporal proximity itself. And there is also a retaliation claim when she retreated back to her assessor's office position. However, this was 4 months after she filed the NEOC complaint. In Helverings, court said that the temporal proximity to create pretext for an inference of retaliation has to be very close. 2 weeks is barely close enough, as the Eighth Circuit, cited by this court in Helverings, had said. There's substantial undisputed evidence that the county was concerned about Ms. Stevens' job performance prior to any complaints and discrimination. She had the two verbal warnings, the verbal reprimand. She had one suspension, and she had a second suspension pending when she first raised the issue of discrimination at the very end of her appeal meeting. It was the very end. The rebuttal letter where she rebutted her initial suspension makes no mention of discrimination. She was concerned primarily because she didn't want her past errors, which were not being internally found. These are errors that the public was bringing to the attention of her supervisors, and that was at the Personnel Policy Board meeting. Her supervisor testified that it was these external errors that he was concerned about because this is a public office, and he was getting concerns from the public about these errors.
Can I just backtrack to you? You made a comment about the proximity was 4 months, so it's too far when she goes back to her mapping job, too far from the NEOC. But they wouldn't have had an opportunity to retaliate against her because she left that department, right? I mean, wasn't this the first opportunity if they were going to retaliate to do it?
She had been there for almost a month. She'd been there for 19 days. She made 19 errors during that time. 19 errors during 19 days. And this was in addition, when she was warned before she retreated, that the county could not ignore her prior disciplinary actions, that her prior errors were going to be considered if she did retreat. And she made the decision to retreat. And in that time, less than a month, she made 19 errors. And that was when she was her supervisor at that time and the director of HR proposed her termination and ultimately did terminate her. But this was after she had been counseled, she had been having counseling, she had been moved to a different division, she had some, in order to eliminate some of the distractions that she was having on a daily basis, some of her duties were actually removed and given to another employee in the office to try to attempt to reduce the number of errors.
But Ms. Osborne says that other employees made those kinds of errors and they weren't terminated.
There's no evidence that any employee made the type of errors that Ms. Stevens made with that type of frequency and that type of seriousness. And in order to be comparable errors, they must be of comparable frequency and comparable seriousness. And her supervisor testified at her appeal hearing that if an employee had made those types of errors, the employee would similarly be disciplined. However, there was no evidence that there was an employee that had made these types of errors. I see that I'm out of time, if I may briefly conclude. The county would ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank
you. How long did we take Ms. Larson over? Ms. Osborne, would you like another minute, 28 seconds?
Thank you. I would note there was some confusion and some questioning about Mr. Sidham's charge of discrimination and the fact that it was offered through a deposition testimony. I think that that is just a red herring. That's a moot point. This affidavit, this charge of discrimination, could have been offered independent of this deposition. And I think that there's a lot of time and a lot of energy spent on that. I think that there was a lot of questioning, and I think it was appropriately raised, whether or not the temporal proximity of Ms. Stevens' return to the Register of Deeds could support a finding of pretext. And I think that there is significant evidence that it could. And she still was ongoing and was participating in the NEOC process. And she's asserting her rights through the collective bargaining agreement, which is a Helverings case, considers that to be, and I think that's supported in a FEPA claim, protected rights. And so there is evidence that she's continuing to do things, and those are the things that are immediately causing her grief within her employment. And that they're noting 19 errors in 19 days. This is, again, this laser focus on Ms. Stevens, as opposed to what they admittedly said, well, everyone makes mistakes and things like that. There are statements like that that are not disputed and should support at least a finding that summary judgment is inappropriate and that there are genuine issues of material fact for a jury to conclude. And so I would ask that the matter be remanded for trial by jury. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. Counsel is excused. Thank you.